What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 114, Emergency Medicine, recorded October 8th, 2014. Our guests this week are Dr. Paul Aline and Dr. Andrew Lee. Dr. Paul Aline is from Neighbors Emergency Center. He is a chief medical officer for the one here in Pasadena at the Fairmont location. And just about the Neighbors Emergency Centers, if you don't have them in your community, they've been voted number one by many of their local communities as a alternative emergency room to like the big hospitals, those kind of things. So definitely check them out if you're in their neighborhood. Dr. Andrew Lee is an assistant professor of primary care sports medicine for the UT Physicians. He's been in the profession for about 5 years, and he works right now with Memorial Hermann, and he's one of our doctors that does the sideline stuff, and we also takes care of our Saturday injury clinics. And so I've met Dr. Lee a couple times, and so I'm excited to hear about emergency medicine from both these guys that have some pretty good experience. And then we also have joining us Dr. Mark Knobloch. Shakira, you switched to them. Dr. Mark Knobloch and Matt Barnes, right? All right. So they're joining us from the University of Houston Masters of Athletic Training Program again. And I'm always excited to have them. And as I was telling Dr. Knobloch via Twitter, that I love having future athletic trainers here on the show because, as you know, some of my students may be athletic trainers. Those guys in the Master of Athletic Training Program are going to be athletic trainers. So it's always good to have you guys and your students involved. So thanks again. I am your host, Jeremy Jackson, and with me today,
Jose,
Bernice,
Shakira,
Gabby,
Olivia, Jess.
And I already introduced those other guys, and they'll be talking here in a minute. If you want to join the show, Shakira is going to be watching the people that register and the CEUs. You can comment there in the comment section. Bob is on the Twitter hashtag DSMB, so you can or tweeting directly to me at PHS Sports Med. Bernice is new on the Ustream social feature, so hopefully she'll see that if you use the Ustream. And again, links to those are on the website. Without much further ado, we're going to get right to it.
Dr. Aline, please tell us who you are and what you do.
Hi, my name is Paul Aline. I'm an emergency physician. For those that don't know what that is, if anyone's ever been to a hospital in an emergency room, the doctor that normally takes care of you if you have a broken bone, a cut, or, you know, if you're having abdominal pain or a fever, I'm that doctor that would come take care of you. The emergency department is considered the fail-safe for society when most people don't have a doctor or may not have insurance. You know, they go to the emergency room because they need to be taken care of right away. Right now, there's a big push in the emergency rooms around the country because of that Ebola outbreak that everyone's very fearful of. So people like me or my colleagues are on the front lines having to deal with those potential patients. I've been in Houston, Texas for the past 12 years, board certified in emergency medicine. Currently, I'm the chief medical officer of Neighbors Emergency Center, which is a conglomerate of freestanding emergency rooms here in Texas. We have locations in Pasadena at Center Street and Fairmont Parkway. We also have locations in Pearland, Kingwood, Baytown, and Bel Air. What is a freestanding emergency department? We have the same capabilities as the hospital emergency room, but what most people realize when they go to the hospital is that they end up waiting for very long periods of time. So anyone today, who's ever been to an emergency room, sometimes you'll be waiting 3, 4, 5 hours. I used to be on faculty at Ben Taub, and the wait sometimes there would be 24 hours before you got seen by a physician. My group that got together and formed these freestanding emergency rooms realized that many patients, you know, don't want to wait that length of time for treatment, and they can get better treatment rather than be rushed through the system. So that's a little bit about me, and I'm excited to hear about everyone else.
Can you talk briefly about your schedule?
Emergency medicine is one of the, I would say, the better schedules in medicine. The doctors in the previous generation before mine, those were the doctors that worked the 36 hours straight, go home, sleep for 4 hours, and get up and do it all over again. My generation of doctors started to realize, you know, there needs to be a balance between being very dedicated to your profession as well as having a good lifestyle. So most emergency physicians work shift work, which means they work, 10 to 12 hours a day. And then they're off. They're never on call, meaning in medicine, there's a very common thing. It's called being on call, which means you need to be responsive to your patients or to the hospital if someone has a need. Emergency medicine, since we do not have patients of our own, once you're off of work, no one's ever going to call you unless there's a shortage at the hospital or something. So in that way, I can spend time with you guys all here today and not have to worry about, I have a patient. I have 1 o'clock office. I got to get back to see my patients. There's a little bit more liberty in my schedule. And that also provides flexibility if I ever decide that, you know, I want to move from Texas. I want to move to a different part of the country. I can just pick up and hit the ground running. I don't have to worry about building up a patient practice. So that was a long answer to a very short question of what my schedule is like. It's basically shift work where I work on average about 144 hours a month.
Dr. Lee, please tell us who you are and what you do.
Hello, everybody. My name is Dr. Andrew Lee. As stated before, I'm actually one of the primary care sports medicine doctors with UT Physicians. One of a few, but I'm basically out here on the southeast side of town. I do work in the Department of Orthopedics, and I do sports medicine coverage for Pasadena ISD. My board certification training is in primarily family medicine, and then I did a subspecialty training in sports medicine, which I absolutely love to do. My other location that we have clinic, which is a little bit different from Dr. Lean, is we do have clinic, which is over here at Memorial Hermann Southeast and Medical Plaza 1, as well as our second location in Pearland, 518 and 288. For the most part, my practice is based during regular business office hours, and we're almost the opposite to what Dr. Lean does. And is pretty much regular scheduled hours from a Monday through Friday. But not only that, with my practice, I usually see a lot of sports injury clinics and sports injuries in those clinics. And usually they've been seen by an ER doctor first, or if not seen by ourselves with some of our other providers, such as athletic trainers on the field during some gameplay as well. So usually, at least for our district over here, we have football games on Thursday, Friday, even Saturdays, and myself and a few other team physicians will cover those and be present during those games. And not only that, I do see patients during the week, usually after clinic hours, during some training room sessions to see if there are any other student athletes that were missed during that time. So other than that, we do try to see on-field emergencies, but we don't see any type of emergencies such as those in a freestanding ER or hospital ER that's more traditional.
Dr. Lean, I have a question for you, and this is off topic, but sure. You brought up a great point. It's kind of a pet peeve of mine. You said a 24-hour wait in an emergency room.
Sure.
Kind of counterproductive. So my question is that more of a staffing issue, or is it more that people are flooding the ER with non-emergency problems? Because if it was truly an emergency, you'd think they get right in. They've got, you know, a heart attack or, you know, chest pains or, you know, severe bleeding. Would you say it's more that the hospital staffing is the issue, or that people are just flooding it with, my finger hurts, I'm going to go to the ER because I'll get seen faster? What would you say in your experience?
From my experience is that, you know, the majority of people use the emergency department as a means of convenience. And so you're right. It's not the true emergencies. When you think of an emergency, that's very subjective. Having abdominal pain for 2 hours is an emergency to some people, whereas other people will be like, okay, I'm going to drink some water, or I'm going to drink a soda. Maybe it's just a little bit of gas. We'll see how I'll do, you know, by tomorrow. Same thing. There's a lot of people that bring their babies in that have fevers. How long have you had fever for? Oh, the fever just started an hour ago. I don't think we're as a society, I don't think we've done a very good job of educating people about basic health care. You know, they sell Motrin and Tylenol over the counter, yet some people don't really understand that Motrin and Tylenol are used for fever. And so I think the problem is really a cultural problem, in that we're very much an instant gratification society, and people, as soon as they start feeling bad, they feel as though that's not a normal state of existence and something needs to be done about it right away. That's, you know, why people oftentimes they may have a runny nose, scratchy throat only for a day, but they already want antibiotics because they feel like I'm getting sick. I just need to get this nipped in the bud. And that's part of the cycle of or part of the problem where we're not properly educating people. But it's definitely not a staffing issue. It's really a matter of people don't have doctors, people don't have insurance, and people want convenience. That's the trifecta of why the emergency department is overcrowded. And I would say more so the fact that people don't have doctors and don't have insurance. And those two are very closely tied together, because obviously if you don't have any insurance, or which means you may not have any money, what doctor is going to be willing to see you? And so the push for healthcare, Obamacare is, you know, a really hot button issue in the country. It comes from good intentions, and I know people have different opinions one side or the other. But at the end of the day, there needs to be a solution for people who can't fend for themselves, whether that be because they are too lazy to do that, or, you know, they have psychiatric issues, family issues. We as a society need to create a system that is a fail-safe other than the emergency department.
What are the worst-case scenarios you see in your clinic?
Who do you want to start with? Hmm? Who do you want to start with?
Mr. Aline.
Dr. Aline.
Yeah, Dr. Aline.
All right.
Well, working in the emergency room, you basically, I say the only people who see things worse than what we do are the police officers and the firefighters who are and the EMS personnel who are the first responders. They see all the people that never even make it to the hospital, that aren't even worth being transported because they're in such a bad condition that, you know, mortality is imminent. So, but in terms of what you see in the emergency room, it's not as exciting as when you watch Grey's Anatomy or ER. It's never like that. And things don't happen as quick as they do on TV. You know, someone comes in with a gunshot and all of a sudden they have all these tubes in. Within 30 seconds, the patient's stabilized. That's not how things happen in real life. But I think when people say, like, what is the scariest or the weirdest thing you've ever seen? There's always the lady that presents to the emergency department who didn't know she was pregnant and saying, I have abdominal pain. And next thing you know, there's a baby being delivered. And it's like, this could have easily been avoided if you just, you know, were honest. The thing about being in the emergency room is that it's one of these places that is, I don't know what the proper term is. It's not class sensitive. So what I mean by that is that you can take care of the CEO of a major corporation, and you can take care of a homeless person as well. And all those people are thrown into one environment, and it makes for a very interesting workplace. Emergency medicine is probably one of the few areas in medicine where people are not as politically correct and professional as you expect them to be. And I think that's just a way of people dealing with a very stressful environment, is to, you know, kind of use sarcasm and off color humor to get through a difficult situation. And so, but, you know, just to be quick, if you want to hear about things I've seen, homeless people who have sores on their legs, they come in and they have maggots crawling through their skin. Oh. That's kind of disgusting. You know, you have your traditional gunshots where people who are, you know, wanting to shoot someone else or, you know, shoot themselves, they miss. And then you see the outcome of what happens when that happens. I've seen people pour bleach which is not bleach like what you have at home, Clorox. They're more industrial strength bleaches that are very basic that you can pour on your skin, and they kind of burn through your skin like the Alien movies, if you've ever seen that. I've seen that when people pour that on one another. So those kind of things are very traumatizing.
All right, so Dr. Lee?
Well, I wish I had as much experience to say that we had that coming through our clinic, but at the same time, we're not the emergency room. So in our clinic in the Department of Orthopedics, my colleagues, I'd say, would probably see some of the bone injuries, fractures, open fractures, those type of things that need to be consulted, which have to be taken to the operating room or operating theater. But as far as walking into the clinic, we hardly ever see anything as bad as that. Serious injuries, big topic of consideration in the sports world is concussion. So we do see things like that. Depending on the severity, those can last for a period of time as well. But, you know, a lot of things that we see are usually screened out from the emergency room. And then eventually what we see in our clinic is what is actually sent to us down the road, down the line. So depending on what it is, it can be from your ankle, something simple as an ankle sprain to something that requires surgery. But with some of the orthopedic surgeons I work with, there's different subspecialties of different orthopedic surgeons. There's the emergent would be trauma, which can see major accidents and things like so. But in our clinic, we tend to see a lot of the sports injuries. So it can be something as simple as open fractures, dislocations, which need to be reduced. But sometimes those are already seen by the emergency doctors as well.
All right. So obviously, I asked you to come on here. When we first met, you were telling me you were trained in emergency medicine, and you spent some time in emergencies.
So,
medicine in the hospitals, right?
Well, I actually did a lot of urgent care, right, which is one step lower. And a lot of the doctors who are trained in urgent care, they can mostly internal medicine and family medicine, and even these days, sometimes can be staffed by nurse practitioners or even mid-level providers too. So there's a difference between most of those from that case to here, and as traditional ERs, that ERs are typically open 24/7, whereas urgent cares and those are not. And not only that, those patients who require more further attention need to be transferred and need to be transferred to an emergency room setting for more appropriate care. Because a lot of what you may see in urgent care, yes, there's convenience to that, but some patients do not realize that some situations may be more emergent or need further workup.
All right, so since our target audience is athletic trainer, Jose's got a good question for you.
Any recommendations for athletic trainers dealing with broken bones?
Who are you going to start with?
Dr. Ali.
I consider the athletic trainers to be the first responders. They see the athlete initially after the injury. And so their management can either make a bad situation a little bit better or make things worse. And what I mean by that, if you see someone that has a severe injury, the most important thing is to stabilize it. And, there are too many injuries to say, well, how do you stabilize this versus that? But assuming that they've been properly trained is really to stabilize injuries such that no further injury can happen or is greatly minimized. And then the things that are emergent, for example, if there's a bone sticking through the skin, that needs to be handled a lot more aggressively than someone who just twisted an ankle or something or, sprained a shoulder. And so it's really letting athletic trainers know that their primary job is to make sure that no further injury happens to the athlete. And again, I trust most medical professionals that everyone, as long as they've been adequately trained, knows how to handle any given situation. And so I see athletic trainers as very helpful and, actually probably saved my butt a few times too.
All right, so Dr. Lee, same question.
I absolutely agree with what Dr. Aline has said. With me being on the field, a lot of the times we work very, very closely with our athletic trainers. As far as emergency medicine situations, from that type of perspective, since a lot of athletic trainers are covering events as well, we try to do a lot of protocols and activate some type of protocol in which, before an emergency even happens, we already know what to do in certain situations and who to call. If that means being prepared and having some type of response beforehand, that is absolutely what we should try to do to help with any situation that which may arise.
So I have a question for you. In the educational side, it's frustrating for me as an instructor with the students. The atmosphere that they're taught in is very calm, very collected. the patient, which is another student, is laying there perfectly still. Can you explain, and I don't want to necessarily focus on you, Dr. Lean, but you probably see the scenario I want the students to see, which is the emergency room. What is the characteristic of an average patient that comes in with a traumatic injury besides the unconscious person that's there? Are they crying? Are they screaming, scared? How do you deal with that from a physician side?
I think, everyone deals with pain a little bit differently. I think, I've seen people with open fractures or compound fractures with a bone sticking through the skin. I've seen people be relatively calm with that. And then I've seen other people with that same, and then there's people who twist their ankle and they're crying. I need a shot of morphine. I'm dying. And so I think you have to really cater your response to your patient. I think the one thing I always tell my patients, regardless of how much pain they present with, is to let them know, you're safe. We're going to take care of you. We're going to make you better. And so I think the advice I would give to any athletic trainer is, empathize with the person going through the injury. It's like, you're going to be okay. We're taking good care of you. Tell me it looks like, you twisted your knee or this looks like it may be broken. We're going to splint it up for you. But don't worry. You're going to be okay. We're going to take good care of you. As long as you kind of keep their mind off of what's going on, it tends to calm down the situation. And then people, once the adrenaline starts wearing off, they start, absorbing more of what the situation is really going on. Most people will be able to get through the situation and be like, yeah, I got hurt real bad. But the most thing is for you not to freak out. If the patient is freaking out, you always have to remain calm. And that goes back to your training and that goes back to your experience. When I first got out of school or residency, you have a certain amount of experience, but you don't have as much as you're going to get in what I consider the real world. And as that real world experience builds up for you and you're in situations over and over again, you start to become a little bit more calm because you already know how to respond. Unfortunately, a lot of things we learn in school don't really apply in the real world. Because, like you just said, the fellow students, you're examining your student, they're nice and calm, but then they're, patients, when you're taking care of them, dropping the F-bomb at you, and you just have to be, real mindful that you have to always remain professional and not get frustrated because they're going through a very stressful situation.
Dr. Lee, do you see that ever in the clinic, or is it pretty much filtered out by the time they see you, or do you still have these patients that you're spending more time on calming them down first, or is it?
Well, usually sometimes it's more of a miscommunication as to what they're being diagnosed with sometimes, and being able to communicate with the patient to explain what's going on. Okay, so a lot of times they can take a lot of time and be kind of stuck on one thing, but as long as you have a plan and explain to them where we're going with this, then they seem to comprehend a little bit more of what's going on. So, but from a clinic perspective, that's where I see it from all the time.
So could you talk about, I know, and I was athletic trainer clinically for quite a few years. I know my mindset when I'm running out on the football field, when you have triage or you have you get the phone call that there's a car wreck coming in, or when you were in urgent care, what is your mindset of, obviously you don't say, oh, we're getting an x-ray at start. My mindset was, what is the worst case scenario as I'm running out there? How do you, because you have a lot more resources, you have pharmaceuticals, you have x-ray. How do you kind of narrow down what your first step is and your second step is from a physician aspect?
Well, with a true traumatic patient, there's everything is very programmatic. And the reason it's that way is that you never want to miss anything. So they always teach you the ABCs. So when a patient first comes in from a traumatic injury, the first thing, A, stands for airway, is the person breathing. Because if the person's not breathing, it doesn't matter where they're injured, they're not going to make it until you secure their airway. The next thing after that is the B, which stands for their breathing. It's not so much about the fact that they're actually moving air, but how are they moving it? Are they moving very rapidly? Is one side of their chest expanding and the other side not? That's a sign that there may be some chest trauma and they may need some help with their breathing there. And finally, last thing is circulation, C, circulation. And that really goes to, what's their blood pressure? Are there any areas that you notice that they're actively bleeding? You have to stop those areas because, obviously if they continue to bleed and continue to lose blood, it's going to lower their blood pressure and, it'll lead to more complications. And so that's, no matter who comes to the door, that's always the same process. So there's many times you have someone come in a car accident, they come into a trauma center, you start cutting off their clothes, they're strapped down to a board with a C collar, and you know, they're saying, all I did was hurt my ankle. But we're going through our whole evaluation just because we don't want to miss anything, because you may have a broken ankle that's considered a distracting injury. And so you may have a C-spine fracture as well, but you can't really tell because your ankle's killing you so bad, you can't feel pain anywhere else in your body. So that's why there's really, you know, there is no freaking out or anything, because it's all prepared in your mind how you're going to treat this patient. And I would assume the same thing on the football field or any athletic field. You run out there, okay, is this patient breathing? Are they alert? Okay, can they talk to me? And especially in football, can they move everything? That's what I would think. I know you can think. I know you're answering my questions, but lift your right hand, lift your left hand, foot. Okay, I don't suspect a spinal injury or a very significant one at this point. That'll let me breathe a little bit easier and then start going through kind of the secondary survey.
And I think what you demonstrated very well. Are you breathing? Okay, my stress level's high. They may not be breathing. Okay, they're breathing. Come down a level. They have movement. They're down a level. It's not a neck injury.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, there's this wave that comes over. Like, okay, it's just an orthopedic. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, you know, we're going to do this. Can we get them off the field? If not, we'll do a little things here. But yeah, I think you're right. But I mean, you see on TV, it's just utter chaos. They call it organized chaos. To me, it looks like chaos. But I was just curious. And do you see anything? In the clinic, obviously, they come in with a much more specific thing. But, you know, obviously, you're probably not going to say, oh, we're x-raying. You have a thought process. What is your thought process going through, even on an orthopedic clinic situation?
Well, it has to be exactly the same thing. It's the same process, maybe not as extreme. But, you know, sometimes, you know, a patient will come in with some type of injury, but really it's not that. So a lot of the things we see is shoulder pain, and it actually could be neck, you know. So a lot of it comes to at that point. When they're coming to the clinic, it's about going over your H&P, your history and your physical exam. Getting a good history as best as you can will basically dictate what you're going to do at that point, because they've already been stabilized now. So a lot of that will dictate what your plan will be from there. So getting a good history and physical.
I think they have a more challenging job from the standpoint of they have to trust whatever recommendations and what we said. And there's some camaraderie or collegiality in medicine, but there's also that little element of, I don't really trust what this other doctor said. I want to do my own evaluation. So it's when they're sent to a clinic, that doctor then has to make sure that whatever I did or a fellow emergency physician did was the right thing for the patient, because they're going to end up dealing with the long-term consequences of the patient. I did the initial stabilization. I put them in a splint. But if the patient has any kind of compression or any kind of vascular problem, they're going to have to deal with that long term, not me.
All right. So, Dr. Lee, it's kind of the same question is on the field. So, you know, emergency situation, typically what I've seen with our doctors is they'll let us, the athletic trainers, go out on the field, and then they'll kind of slowly walk out there so that we're the one being, I guess, first in charge, and then they come up for support.
Right.
Talk to me about your program or your whatever it is for on the field, you know, immediate care.
Sure. So it depends on where you've trained at, and it comes down to preparation. It all comes down to preparation. You want to know what's going on and who you're working with before you go out and start the game. So if it means knowing you've got EMS on site and you've got an ambulance, paramedics who are there with you that can help, then great. Also, as well as athletic trainers, are there athletic trainers for one team, both teams, are there other doctors there too? So a lot of it's preparation before the game even starts. So you want to go and meet and greet and see who you've got available. A lot of times it just depends. It could be from a middle school, high school, collegiate, professional level. There are different, set ways or protocols that are done, and there can be hand signals between the athletic trainers if the trainers have gone out there first. But those have to all be established beforehand. Because you don't want to, like, if the doctor's on the sideline and they're not going to come out, but they're missing something, they want to be known or be alerted as soon as possible. Obviously, you know, they're not watching the game just to watch a great game of what's of some sort. They're watching a game to see how what's going on. There are hits, there's certain plays, what action is going on. So, you know, they're also being vigilant with their eyes. They may not be the ones with their hands immediately there, but then once they go on, they'll follow on the same what we would call standard of care with the ABCs, which have may have already been initiated once they reach the field. Now, as far as who's out there, when you get onto the field, it's typically the person who's got the most type of medical experience that will then have to determine who's giving the what we call orders or who's kind of directing what has to be done. So at sometimes it may not even be the physician. The athletic trainer may have much more experience with dealing with, let's say, head injuries, which could very well be more emergent and stabilizing that C-spine than a local doctor who doesn't necessarily deal with that, who's just covering a game. So in that respect, if it appears as if, you know, beforehand, they'll want to know who's got more experience and who can take over to take help and direct that process altogether.
That's interesting that you, as an orthopedic surgeon, orthopedic doctor, that you've said that I may have more experience than a doctor covering. I would have honestly never expected you
well,
to say that.
Well, when I say that, it depends on what level. So if you're at a professional level, you usually have some type of emergency medicine doctor or a primary care doctor who deals with the medical aspect of side of things, but you may also have an orthopedist. And there's different types of sports medicine doctors out there. So myself, I'm primary care sports medicine based, but you may also have an orthopedic sports medicine based doctor who's out there. Sometimes in the more professional leagues, you'll have a whole team of different subspecialty type doctors who will be able to take care of different type of aspects. So depending on what level you're at, especially at a high school level, you never know who's going to be out there, what type of doctor may be out there. It could be any type of healthcare professional for that matter who may be covering a football game.
That reminds me, one of my colleagues is actually one of the physicians for the Houston Texans, and he's an ER doctor, just like me. And his responsibility on the team is in case anyone goes into cardiac arrest. He is there. His responsibility is to carry the defibrillator. And so, you know, in the many years of the NFL history, I don't think there's anyone who's ever had.
He gets to watch a lot
arrest.
Of good football.
Exactly. So that's his responsibility. But, you know, in his mind, he's like, well, I can't screw it up. I don't want to be the first doctor who, you know, let an NFL player die because he couldn't revive him, you know.
The officials are the ones you need to watch.
Exactly.
So I have a question, and it's for both of you. You get a call on the radio. You pick up a chart out of the door, mm-hmm. off a patient's door. What makes you nervous? What would be the scenario that, you know, in your experience, you're like, oh, I've really got to be on my game? For me, it's head injury. I don't mind this potential C-spine. It's, you know, spine mortem syndrome. But what makes you really, what would kind of get your nerves up a little bit if you heard this coming in on the radio, or if Dr. Lee, if you saw a patient's chart on your door as you walk in the room? What do you think, either one of you?
I mean, my nightmare patient I've been through a lot and seen a lot. But the only thing I worry about in terms of patient is someone who's morbidly obese, 400, 500, 600 pounds, and can't breathe, and they need to have an airway inserted. Normally, we have equipment that we use, or it's called a laryngoscope, and we can put a tube down in, you know, 99% of people. But, you know, those morbidly obese patients are very difficult to take care of. And even in terms of getting an IV in them or getting any kind of vascular access is very difficult. So those subset of patients, I always worry. I don't know what it's going to be. The heaviest patients I ever took care of was about 650 pounds. He was very sick. And the medical equipment at the time, it's starting to catch up now, but CAT scanners and X-ray tables were never meant for that level of weight for a patient. In my career, those patients, when I first started out, actually we had to transfer them to the zoo to get CAT scans and things like that, because that was the only place in the city where they had equipment that was meant for that level of poundage. And so definitely any morbidly obese patient with a breathing problem, it kind of makes me nervous.
So on that note, from a clinic perspective, it's going to be something similar to that. But depending on what we see in the orthopedic department, as far as emergencies are potentially arising, obviously it's someone with shortness of breath. Anybody with we look for potential leg clots, okay, or deep venous thromboses. Those could break off and go into become a pulmonary embolus, for example. Those could potentially be emergencies. And so the problem with being in the clinic is we don't have what we have accessible in the emergency room. So the ancillary tests in order for us to make those diagnoses, other than when they're already going downhill or they're starting to change. And what we look for is their vital signs. So vital signs are exactly what they say. They're vital signs. So any time we see a patient in the clinic, we want to look at what's going on there and be able to see if there's anything that may be alerting us to where we may have to send them to the emergency room for further testing.
All right. So I kind of missed part of this when we were talking about fractures because I was answering the phone. So I once went to a workshop, and it was a orthopedic surgeon, and he said, you know, if there's a dislocation or fracture, I don't mind you trying to reduce it, say like an ankle dislocation or, you know, definitely fingers, we do those often, but he said that I don't mind you trying to reduce it by straightening it out. How do you guys feel about that? Because usually if there's a fracture, if you reduce it or, you know, put it back in place, it causes a lot less pain. But then I know that it can also cause damage, you know, cutting off circulation or that kind of things. How do you feel about that, Dr. Lee? Why don't you start?
Well, you know, obviously we have to check their ABCs and a vascular, and really for that it's more of the nervous and a vascular compromise to see if that any of that is compromised. So if we can, I have no problems with if it has to be emergently done to go ahead and try and do it to help that patient out. Mm-hmm. Now, once that's stabilized, by this time, you've already called 911. You've already got them taken care of. We have a plan as to who's going to go ahead and take care of them afterwards. So if, as long as Dr. Lean said, is from an athletic trainer's perspective, is to try and stabilize that patient, and that's part of the whole process of stabilization.
So in your opinion, it's okay if it helps stabilize the patient?
Absolutely.
Or if you'd have compromised nerve or,
exactly,
or circulation?
Dr. Lean, any other?
Yeah, I think that really depends on the professional judgment and training of the person who's trying to do the reduction of the fracture or dislocation. You know, we live in a society where if you do something and you cause more damage, you'll eventually find out about it, you know, through the legal system. So I don't think anyone would necessarily take the risk to do something that they weren't 100% comfortable with. So if you're in a situation, it's for example, even though I'm a physician, I would never imagine doing a C-section or doing heart surgery on someone. And so it's the same thing. If you are an athletic trainer, but you have enough experience with fracture reductions and dislocations, then by all means, go ahead and do it. But if you are not that comfortable and you're just kind of trying something out, you know, I just saw this on YouTube, let me see if it works, then, you know, then I wouldn't advise it. Yeah.
I guess a lot of it comes to what's in your scope of your practice. Mm-hmm. Is a term that we probably hear quite a bit. So, I absolutely agree with his comments there.
All right, so Dr. Knobloch, you guys are teaching the next generation. Is this something like fracture reduction? Is that something that is part of your instruction?
We didn't do reduction. We did more. It was more of a stabilization, you know, vacuum splints, air splints, but soft splints. So I'm not comfortable. Now, fingers, I've reduced many times, dislocations, not fractures. Shoulder, I've seen it done two different ways. I have not done one myself, so I don't feel confident teaching something that I'm not. But I think it's more of, just like they said, Dr. Aline said especially, was if you're comfortable in your training, they're not going to get that training from me because I don't feel comfortable and I don't know, you know, there is the situation, you dislocate your shoulder, you compress the arteries flowing through there, you compress a nerve, the brachial nerve or something, that's possible. But they're going to get pretty quick emergency care in this case. And I don't think the compromised blood flow for that amount of time, that, you know, in the 20 minutes gets the hospital. And Dr. Lane, you could tell me if, please tell me if I'm wrong, because I want to make sure we get it right. But to me, that compromise is not as bad as it, as if what could happen is if I reduce it and we compress or we sever an artery through a bone or something. So in my class, the emergency care, I don't teach reductions of fractures. I teach stabilization, take care of the patient, take care of the fracture, get them to the hospital. Now, actually, I can throw the question back at you. Would you teach, and I'm curious, would you teach reductions, or what do you think in your background? Would you feel confident teaching that?
All right, so here at the high school, obviously it's different.
Mm-hmm.
I would show if I was reducing, you know, a thumb or a finger, something like that, and a dislocation, I would show the students, because it's an experience that they have, and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they're at home and they dislocate their finger, their brother yeah. does, something like that, and so then they have at least have an idea of what to do.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to say, okay, this is the proper way to do this, mm-hmm. because I don't think I've been instructed this is the proper way. It's just been, you know, doctors on the sidelines or, you know, at clinics saying, you know, this is how I do this. Mm-hmm. But nobody volunteers, again, to dislocate their finger or break their bone so that we can practice
right.
it.
I mean, and I, you know, back in the 90s, I had gone through EMT training. We had hair traction splints and all that. And the standard accepted practice, I guess, was just stabilize and get them to the hospital. Let the pros do it. Because if something goes wrong and all of a sudden they lose feeling, well, do I put traction on the bone again, maybe try and get that nerve free or what? Well, let them, you know, get them to the hospital, let the experts do it, that if there's something does go wrong, the emergency care is right there for them. But that's my philosophy. That's not a standard. That's not taught across the board. I think a lot of it is your training level, like Dr. Lean said. And so I don't teach them reduction of fractures, because the other question is, how do you know it's even, you know, is it displaced? Well, is there a gross deformity? Or is it, you know, or what if they're an offensive lineman and there's just have a big leg, you can't see it? Stabilize it, get them to the hospital. Make sure you call 911 first, get the ambulance on the way while you're going through all this. By the time the ambulance gets there, I don't really think the reduction is going to make a difference anyway. If the paramedics want to do it, so be it, or get them to the hospital. But, you know, I stress that's my philosophy on it. And I don't want to put them in a situation where they have to decide, well, this is, you know, Dr. Knoblock said that if they see one leg shorter than the other and it's a potential hip fracture, we should put traction on a leg. You know, I'd rather them get to the hospital and go from there. But, you know, we have experts here that can tell you that what they recommend too.
All right. So in the EMT training, and, you know, and Dr. Lee, you're talking about knowing the team, knowing who's there. And I guess it just comes down to, you would have to have a detailed conversation, but in your opinion, is the athletic trainer going to be the one that should be calling the shots, or the EMT? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's basically who knows the team better, and you need that good rapport at that time. So usually the EMTs, it may be this different crew at each game.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So when it comes down to, let's say, the team doctors or the athletic trainers, they're the ones who have a good rapport and understanding. And as you know yourself, when I see some of the kids here, we're a team and a collaborative team together. And so we're always working with them, and we know a little bit of their history. And this all comes down to preparation. So, you know, it's knowing them before the season even starts, you know, and knowing what their baselines are and how their health is in general. And so from a high school level, you're pretty much, you know, there for them. You know, and right. you know them probably the most, even more than we do as physicians. Mm-hmm. And we only usually see them when they're ill for something. So, you know, there's a great role for athletic trainers, and for anybody in a part of the healthcare team who's providing such care on a daily basis, you know.
And I can speak as a former EMT, 6 months of training to get your certification to deal with any emergency care is just not what I think it should be. Now it may have changed since then, but also no, and it's not as, to me, it wasn't as big of a deal in a town, in a city like Houston. It's the small towns in the middle of nowhere where the EMT at the game is also the, and I don't mean to make fun of this, but this is a situation, is also the donut shop owner, and they're also an EMT. And so they come to the game, and for me to hand off care to them, I don't know if that's the best patient care available. When I have, you know, 4 or 5 years of training or 2 years of intense training as an athletic trainer, sports medicine, emergency care, et cetera, for me to hand off that to that patient care and let them take charge and tell me what to do. Now, obviously, I have to transport him, but getting him on the spine board, assessing the injuries, I would feel more comfortable with the higher level training. But that's, you know, that's what you get when you get into the small towns, is you just, you have to have somebody there. And if it's the person that's had the 6 months of training and now they're an EMT, do you really want them providing care or telling you what to do when you, just like Dr. Lee said, when you have the rapport with this kid, you know him or her, and you have a lot of training at that level. So, so I think it's, you know, it's a judgment call. The thing I've told people, whatever you do, don't get in an argument over standing over the athlete. Get it settled before. Meet them, greet them, say, hey, you know, I'm licensed, I'm certified as an athletic trainer, here's my training. It's nice to meet you. We love you being here. When I hand this athlete over to you, I'd appreciate, you know, you taking care of them to the hospital. If there's a challenge to that, well, you need to have the conversation. But the last thing you want to do is have an on-field emergency and you two are fighting. I'm doing this. Well, I'm a certified or a registered EMT. Well, I'm a licensed athletic trainer. You know, you never want that situation. So I think getting it laid out beforehand and getting patient care set in line so that when there is an emergency, it makes it a lot smoother too. But I have to say, with 6 months of training, it was a classroom setting, and then I did ER observation, I did a ride along in an ambulance, and then I went to the high school gymnasium and took my certification, or back then it was a registration test, and all of a sudden I'm an EMT. I could have easily been somebody that came right out of high school and has no anatomy, no emergency medicine, none of that stuff. But what they taught me in 6 months, all of a sudden I'm supposed to walk into a house with somebody having chest pains, breathing, and I'm the guy in charge. And I don't mean to discredit them at all. They're very valuable and they are trained. But from an athletic side, I guarantee our protocol, when we worked what was called the river run in my hometown, anybody that fell out of this river run with an ankle injury, blisters, they wanted us, the protocol for the EMT students who were working on the EMTs and the paramedics was to put them on a spine board, put them in an ambulance, get them to the hospital. I mean, how do you, and I was also a student athletic trainer at the time. So I was like, this kid rolls their ankle and we're supposed to spine board without the C-spine, but attach them to a spine board and take them to the hospital for an X-ray. It's like, there's no evaluation. And I was just flabbergasted, but that was what we had to do because we were students. That was the standard that the medical group over that river run, which is a 10K, that was their standard. And that's what we had to do. It was very frustrating to see that. And so that was actually one of my questions for both of you is, how do you, you know, you have an athlete that comes in versus you have a geriatric patient. And I know you said you had a protocol in the ER, but is your mindset different when you have, say, an ankle sprain, an X-ray? Obviously, a geriatric patient or somebody, a non-athlete, or maybe a morbidly obese person, there's going to be some differences, but do you talk to them differently? How do you deal? Or obviously you treat everybody the same, you know, on paper, but what's your mindset or what are you, your outcomes, or how do you see the difference there?
I think the extremes of age, you always have to treat a little bit differently than the general population. So your pediatric population versus your geriatric population, your mindset's a little bit different. So for example, an older person that fell down and hurt their ankle, I want to find out more. Are they falling down? Is this a regular occurrence? You know, they just got hurt this time when they twisted their ankle, but have they been losing their balance? Then I start worrying about more neurological things. Okay, are they, you know, are they developing neurological signs, or are they developing dementia? Then I worry about, is their heart beating properly? Is it the fact that they're standing up? Is their blood pressure dropping and that's the reason that they're starting to fall? Or are they experiencing symptoms of vertigo? So you're what we call a differential diagnosis. It starts to get a lot bigger when someone is older because there's so many other things that could just be, oh, is it a simple ankle sprain? You or I develop a pain in our tooth, you know, we'll be like, oh, you probably just have a toothache. But in someone who's 60, 70 years old, that can be a sign of a heart attack. And so those are the little subtle things that you accumulate over years of experience where you start thinking about, again, the worst case scenario. Oh, yeah. 9 times out of 10 is just a simple toothache, but you know, that one time it's going to be a heart attack. And so you just have to be mindful of those things. Same thing with children and the elderly is that when they get injured, you have to also think, is this abuse? You know? And so you say, okay, did someone push you down while you hurt yourself? And then for children, you know, did someone harm you? Why now you're injured? And that's very common for orthopedic injuries in children. You should never see a child with a broken femur. You know, a kid can fall down. Most kids, when you fall down, even when we were growing up and fell down, you hit your head. Very easily explained, you have a forehead laceration. You fall down and catch yourself on your arm. Understand the mechanism for children, that's going to usually break their elbow. But when you see long bone fractures in the arm, in the leg, in the femur area, you have to suspect abuse. And so that's the only way the mindset changes when you deal with that patient's upset.
Dr. Lee, do you see any difference, or do you have any mindset differences when you have say the same injury, but in a different age group, or an athlete versus a non-athlete? Do you deal with them differently, or do you talk to them differently, or do you clear them? Maybe say, athlete, you can expect 2 weeks, non-athlete, you're out for probably 6 weeks before you're back.
Anytime in medicine, there's no definitive time frame. And that's the one thing everybody wants to get better as soon as they can, or want to have a set defined number or date and when they can, you know, go back to work or go back to doing what they were doing before and they're, you know, the same level. You know, when it comes down to the different age subsets and treating them differently, it's pretty much what Dr. Lean says. It all comes down to trying to figure out what the underlying cause, which causes this. They could have the same, let's say, ankle fracture. But in an athlete, we can see it's from direct trauma, from some type of specific game, perhaps. But from, you know, how did they, from an elderly perspective, how did they fall? And it goes down to what Dr. Lean was saying and trying to get back down, get down to the underlying cause. So I wouldn't say we treat them any differently, but there are certain things we need to try and address and investigate a little bit more in depth to get to why this has even happened. And as far as a treatment plan goes, everybody is a little bit different and everything is individualized for that person and any type of treatment that's for any type of injury for that matter.
I think one of the things when it gets back to educating the population as a whole, you do have to realize that certain people are treated differently than others. And so, for example, if you're a professional athlete, we hear this all the time. Professional athlete, twist their ankle, twist their knee, x-rays negative. What's the next thing you hear? They're going for an MRI. So society, when you watch professional sports, you're already training society, oh, my x-ray is negative, I need to go for an MRI. In the real world, that's not how it works. If your x-ray is negative, If you continue to have issues, we'll arrange an MRI for you, which may happen 1 to 4 weeks from now. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes people, when they enter the healthcare system, they realize, wait a minute, I'm not being treated like Arian Foster or, you know, one of these super elite athletes when I get injured. One of the most common injuries in someone who's like older, like what we call the weekend athletes or the weekend warriors, is a torn Achilles. You know, for a athlete, you know, season's over, they need surgery to get back. For a regular person, assuming that you're not really all that athletic, they may just let that heal on its own without getting surgery. So there is definitely a different way that people are treated when they're, you know, superstar athletes and when they're just average Joe Schmoes like us.
It's kind of like a modified CSI effect, because my wife is in law, okay, and she deals with juries, and juries are like, where's the blood results at? Right. Or it's this, you know, in Law and Order, it goes directly from you've been arrested, and then there's like that sound, and they're in trial.
Right.
What about the year and a half in between?
Right.
You know, it's the media effect, yeah, of the, it's like a medical CSI effect, I guess, for right, that.
All right, so I got we're going to switch just a little bit. I had a student athletic trainer from another school come over here, and it was a hot day outside working a game. And I'm at the other freshman field, so, you know, it's like 300-400 yards away, whatever it is. So someone comes running over. There's somebody having an asthma attack. Okay. All right. Do they have an inhaler? No. And so then they just take off running back. So then, you know, I'm going. Obviously, I'm not sprinting over there, because then I'd be out of breath too. This girl doesn't have an inhaler. So what do I need to do then? Because, you know, you're talking about checking the ABCs. Well, airway, she's having trouble breathing. That's the mm-hmm. first thing. where do I go? She doesn't have an inhaler. Dr. Aileen?
The first thing you have to do is calm her down. And I don't know if you've ever seen that Mel Gibson movie. It's really an M. Night Shyamalan movie, Signs, where the kid at the end is having the asthma attack, and he's talking to him, and he's holding him, and he's just telling him to slow down his breathing. You know, he put the sun to his chest and was like, you know, just mimic my respirations. A lot of times when asthmatics are having a hard time breathing, the first thing that triggers is fear. Oh, my God, I can't breathe. And so that anxiety builds up, and they get more nervous, and they start breathing faster. You have to calm them down. You said you were outside. It was very hot. I would, you know, get someone to carry, whether you carry that person or have people carry her into a cooler environment. And then at that same time as you're talking to her, you just slow down your breathing. Slow down your breathing. Obviously, you know, if enough people around, someone go call 911. So that's already started. But in the meantime, again, just getting her calm, helping her breathe, putting a cool washcloth on her forehead. And that's pretty much all you can do at this point. If they're really in what we call status asthmaticus, meaning their lungs are clamped down and they're not getting any oxygen in, then you're not going to be able to do anything other than just wait for EMS arrival. I don't know if you have oxygen on campus or if you have a tank, you can hook that up. But assuming you don't have those things, the best thing you can do is just put her in a cool place, keep her calm, and wait for, you know, advanced help to arrive.
All right, so we didn't call EMS. By the time I got over there, she was sitting in the car, and she was able to talk to me and stuff like that.
Okay.
And so, you know, by the time I got over there, those first steps had already been taken, minus the calling EMS.
Sure.
So, you know, I talked to her, and she said, you know, I'm feeling a lot better and that kind of thing.
And that was just going in an AC, in the AC car?
Yeah, so she went and sat in the car, and they gave her a bottle of water. So sure. She was drinking some cold water. And so should I have called 911 as soon as somebody says an asthma attack? Or?
Well, again, you were getting secondhand information in the sense you didn't actually see how she was breathing and how she was responding. So if you are there and you're seeing, wait, this girl is in significant distress, I wouldn't hesitate to call 911, especially because you're dealing with kids. You know, I know they're older and teenagers, but still, it's, you know, you don't want that kind of thing to show up on the news. Child having asthma attack at Pasadena High School, you know, school teacher does nothing, you know, does not call ambulance.
No, that would never, that wouldn't be on the news. They wouldn't spin it that way, would they?
Exactly. So it's really more to protect the school, protect yourself, that you did everything that you had available at your disposal to make sure this child was properly taken care of.
Dr. Lee, any other additional thoughts dealing with asthma and no inhalers?
Well, you know, once they're if they're known to be asthmatic, it's one thing is after this event has calmed down, is to make sure they can do every precaution and trying to educate them later on that hopefully this does not happen again. And if that means getting an inhaler or seeing their doctor to know about what they're dealing with, to make sure they have some type of rescue inhaler or whatnot, to have it on board and educate them, make sure they have it with them at all times. Okay. So that's probably the only thing, take-home point at the end, but, you know, I can't disagree with anything that you had done based on the situation that you had presented to you at the time.
So, again, I mean, it comes back to the situation. I feel like if we walk outside, look across the street, there's chemical plants, just miles of chemical plants. So the air is pretty bad here, and we already talked to somebody a year or two ago about asthma and things to do there, but I feel like a lot of kids here, as we were talking about in the beginning, they don't have insurance. And so going to the doctor to get an inhaler or going every year because they expire to get a new inhaler, or having two or three, one to leave in the athletic training room, one to keep with them, one to keep in the nurse's office it should be, yes, the parents want to do that if the kids are going to play sports, but it's kind of asking too much. What are your thoughts on ways that we can prevent not having an inhaler? Do you have any ideas here how we can get our athletes educated or motivated to have that stuff on hand?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it comes down to education as well as financial resources. And I think that's the difficult thing we face as a country, is that how do you provide for people that can't provide for themselves? You know, we complain that the system is broken, you know, from a Medicare, Medicare, Medicaid standpoint. And, you know, I don't know what the solution is. know, I don't know if there needs to be an annual fund, you know, raised for the awareness, and those, the monies, the proceeds from that awareness drive are used for purposes such as this. But I think there are many good causes in the country that people give their dollars towards, and it's just really of a matter of where do you want to spend your dollars. Some people prefer to give their money to religious institutions. Some people prefer to give their money to museums. Some people prefer to give their money to children's hospitals. So I think as a country, we're very generous, but getting people to focus in on one small issue like this is going to be very difficult.
I'm thinking more at the beginning of the season, you know, for a student athlete, and sometimes that pre-participation exam that they get, that physical exam, is probably the only time they actually ever see a physician for any type of screening process.
Right.
So, you know, the it takes the parent and the student to go through it together and address, if they could address all those questions and fill it out as completely as possible, and anything that they have in the back of their mind that may be an issue. A lot of the times, these physicals are either done at urgent cares or you know, walk-in clinics. The problem with that is they don't get to see the doctors so many times, and they clear them very quickly and immediately. It depends on what the process is, and now if it's from a school perspective, it means having a regular doctor that they see, and they'll be able to be around them. It could even be myself, to be able to screen them appropriately and to be able to take the time, because a lot of times it's just getting that piece of paper, because all that athlete wants to do is play for that season and get it cleared. But if it takes a little bit longer for them to be able to talk to a physician or a healthcare provider to address any issues and concerns, and then on a case-by-case basis be able to see whatever they can do to help them out.
Going back to the inhalers, I've seen it, I've heard about it, and I've seen it a lot of times, like, if kids are having chest pains related to asthma, and they'll just borrow their buddy's inhaler. What would be the problems with, or a problem with them using, like, their friend's inhaler, even though it could be the same prescription as, like, ProAir or Ventolin? I've just heard that a lot, so.
I don't know if I should be recorded saying this, but I don't. I mean, technically, there's no problem with using another kid's inhaler. It's the same exact medication. The reason people say that is, you know, is really more to protect themselves from any issue. But, you know, my Vicodin and your and albuterol, your antibiotic, Zithromax, is the same, regardless of whose name is on it. It's just more of a safety issue.
And it might be, too, there's the people that say, well, I have a prescription. I see you're having a hard time breathing. Here's my inhaler.
That's exactly what I've seen usually.
Yeah, and I think then it's a whole different issue. Is what are, you know, do you have any problems with steroids or all this? But
right.
Yeah, I from what I've seen is, you know, I forgot my inhaler today. Mm-hmm. You have the same medicine. Can I have a shot of yours? Is
right.
One thing, but another is, or you know, I've got some, I don't know what's a prescription with a lot of potential side effects, but I'm just throwing out something out. Here's some Celebrex.
Right.
You know, your shoulder's hurting here. Here's, you know, or an antibiotic because you have a cough or whatever. I think that's more of the bigger issue.
Right.
And then obviously the teen abuse of prescription drugs is coming out now. But
sure.
Inhaler is probably the least of their concerns,
right.
I would think.
Yeah,
so,
right.
But it's definitely a problem in high school, especially because the kids are naive to that kind of stuff. It's
right.
Like, oh, well, here, nobody's going to know. Here, take a shot of this or whatever.
Well,
I think it's
a
problem.
A lot of that in high school, because what ends up happening is that kids give each other pills, you know, and it may be Xanax or something, and they show up in the emergency room corked, and everyone's trying to figure out, you know, what did this person take? A few years back, there was this these smoke shops that popped up, and people were smoking this Kush, and so that's what I worry about more so. In the teenage group than, you know, sharing an inhaler. That's pretty minor.
And they probably won't tell you what they took because they're afraid
to
get in trouble.
Exactly.
All right, so as you were saying before, it has to come up. You're headed to Dallas today, Dr. Lee. And one of my students said, don't bring it back with you. So talking about emergency medicine, we actually had a student with a type of meningitis in the last few weeks. So he was in the hospital and they had to come in and do all this fogging of the locker rooms, that kind of thing. So Dr. Lee, talk about those type of emergencies where it's more of a cold or bacteria or virus type thing rather than an orthopedic type injury?
Well, I think the anytime there's what we consider a communicable disease, whether that be, you know, influenza or flu or, you know, just your standard upper respiratory virus, a lot of it is really just about using common sense. If someone around you is sick, you know, make sure that, you know, you wash your hands and you just, you know, don't share the same glass. If you're the person who's sick, you know, cover your cough. You've seen those posters. You know, when you, if you blow your nose and throw the tissue out and then you touch the doorknob handle, just be mindful. Maybe you should wipe it down so you're not transferring anything, to anyone else. I mean, a lot of the reason that people, you know, like there's a flu outbreak is really just because people live in close quarters and sometimes their hygiene is not the best in terms of preventing, you know, these diseases from transferring from one person to another. Even in the healthcare setting, you know, why a lot of people get infections in the hospital is really because I, as a doctor, may see one patient and then I leave the room, I don't wash my hands, and then I go in and I go see another patient. And so now what ends up happening is that that patient had, you know, influenza, and I have now transferred that maybe to this other patient through, you know, my poor hygiene. And I think doctors and nurses are very guilty of this just because we get exposed to so many things. Our immune systems are very strong. It's very difficult to find a doctor who's out sick or a nurse who's out sick because we've been exposed to so many things over the years. Our immune systems are turbocharged. And so, but that doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily the same thing for our patients. And so I would just say, like, when you had that meningitis outbreak in the school or for that one person that had it, as long as the other people around that person were not, you know, that he didn't sneeze or cough on them, it's highly unlikely that they would ever catch anything.
All right. So, Dr. Lee, any other?
On top of that, I mean, we're dealing with, from an athletic population or school population, there's, like you said, you're in such close quarters. Now, they're even closer in a locker room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, we worry about towels, we talk about, we worry about even skin infections and things like that. And then a lot of student athletes won't realize, but depending on the sport that they're playing, they may be ineligible because they may be able to transfer whatever infection they have to another another person that they may be in contact with. So, you know, it's just a lot of things just has to be, when it comes down to education, and at this point in time, a lot of who's here is you. You know, and they have to be able to come up to you and be able to be honest with what's going on with any symptoms of anything and not take it too lightly. And if that means calling a doctor in to have him checked out, then so be it, you know. So but I wouldn't hide and have him be in fear of not being honest with what's going on with any of their symptoms or how they're feeling for that matter. And it could be both, not only other than a medical illness, it could even be a psychological thing too. You know, there could be other things going on too. So you're the forefront.
Awesome. Nick, you look like you have a question. Do you have something?
Oh, no, I wasn't.
So I have Dr. Lee, this may be more for you, but one of the things we have to do, we have to teach, and the students have to do in my class is an emergency action plan.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, in your experience, everybody knows how to do it, what to do, but in your practical experience, do you see anything that you wish more people, more athletic training sites or staffs would do, or failures that, or where there's a break in the chain that that you've noticed consistently that people need to think about for an emergency situation, or on the other side, has it been pretty smooth for you?
I think it just depends on everyone's training and where they've trained at, and it comes to being prepared. Now, where I trained at, I trained, my fellowship was at a NC2A1 school, and everything was laid out, and there actually are handbooks and guidelines. So even though you may have been trained and have gone through the drills, if it's actually written out, because sometimes in the chaos of everything, You may just want to read a script. At least it's standardized and you know what you're going to do, but you need to know who your players and who's involved as far as doing what. Now that can change on an everyday level as far as who's covering what, or, you know, from an athletic trainer's perspective, a physician level, you know, who's in charge of the building, for example. It comes down to even where's the ambulance going to come in, which entrance, which door, you know, evacuation routes. There's so many different things. So if it's, yes, there may be something set in stone that we know about it, but if it's actually in a book somewhere and everyone knows where it is and it's a step by step process, and that seems to be the most helpful that I've seen where I trained at, because usually when it comes to these action plans, they're done maybe once at the beginning of the season, and that's it, and that's what you're going to rely on. But at least that's one is better than none, but hopefully you never have to put that action plan in place. And when it does, you want to make sure you have a guideline as to what to do. So for me, that's what I've seen. Now, it may be different from an institution-by-institution basis, but in general, that seems to be pretty clear.
I'm good.
Okay, so two last things. Well, you kind of talked about it with the students, and students always love to hear horror stories, and the one about maggots crawling out of wounds is pretty gross. I mean, it sounds like just CSI type stuff, something you just see on TV, but I guess that's really where they get it from. Now, do you normally see very many athletes in the Neighbors Emergency Center?
Yes, because of the heightened awareness about concussions, especially during football season, we see people coming in for CAT scans of the head. Basically, when someone hits their head in a football game or any other injury, they show up and they get a picture of their head. It's not really to make sure that do they have a concussion or not. It's really, is there anything more serious going on? Have you suffered a skull fracture? Do you have bleeding around your brain? And so because those are actually a little bit more life-threatening. For example, there was Liam Neeson's wife. When she was skiing, she fell down and hit her head. She kind of ignored it. And it was too late by the time they showed up for medical care because she was having bleeding in her brain. So that's really the primary reason why you get a CAT scan after you suffer a head injury, is to make sure none of the blood vessels in the brain were torn and now you're bleeding internally and just don't know it.
See, that scares me because I'm a parent. I have two young boys and one on the way. And, I mean, falling is part of what they do. Right. So it's like, well, do I need to take them to the emergency room every time? You know, I mean, obviously we're going back to athletic training, but, man, I mean, just with the stuff we know. I mean, this is the same stuff that I did when I was a kid, and I never went to the hospital, but.
I can relate. My youngest, she was 8 months, I think, fell out of her crib, and I was the only one home. And my first thought was, you know, got to go to the ER. And I just sat and I watched her. And the worst part is, stupid me, after she was fine, I stayed with her a good hour. I mean, I got on the internet, and that's the worst thing you can do. And there were, you know, child falls out of crib, and there's message boards, and it was, what kind of idiot are you? How could you not take your kid to the ER? And just things like that. I calm myself as I use my training. She's fine. She's responding. And knowing your kid, obviously she has the same personality, and she was fine, you know, but the worst thing I did was I double checked. What do they do on the internet? What do they say to do on the internet? And you felt like the worst parent in the world because of what you said. You know, obviously this is more than just a fall, but you know, it was that situation. But I know exactly what you mean. When you decide, you know, fell and bumped their head sharp on a sharp corner versus they fell and, you know, their head kind of barely touched the floor. But yeah, it's different when you're a parent too. And our program coordinator, Dr. Yellen, he made the comment when his kid had something like that. He's like, take them. You're the pros, you know, because the emotions are completely different when it's your own kid versus when it's your athlete, or when it's a stranger walks in the room and you know something really bad is going on. You're still calm because there's no emotional connection, but definitely a situation's higher level when it's your own kid or your own family member, I think.
I always tell parents when they come in, because some parents just want to be reassured when they come in, when their kid falls and hits their head. And they don't necessarily want a CAT scan, but they just want my opinion. And I always tell parents, you know, just very globally, when a child hits the front of their forehead, their head, there's a smaller chance of anything significant happening. The front of the skull is very thick, and so it's unlikely that any serious injury is going to happen from a, you know, a regular fall a child will take, even out of a crib. The side of the skull is a lot thinner, and that's where Natasha Richardson, when she hit her head, that's the side of the brain that got affected, is because on the side you can even feel it. It's very thin. Anyone who's into like martial arts or mixed martial arts, they, you know, the forehead can be used as a weapon. That's how thick it is. You can headbutt someone, but that doesn't apply to the back, the sides of your head as well. So those are just kind of points that you can use. You know, if your kid's running and hits his forehead, more than likely nothing's going to happen. And but, you know, side of the head, I even, you know, a little bit more concerned about that because it's the bone is a lot thinner on there.
And I have a, you bring up a question I have is because I have the personality. I want to know worst case scenario right off the bat, but I know parents aren't like that. So when you have not even necessarily a child or a patient, when they come into your hospital and you know something's really bad, how do you address them? Do you, I mean, obviously you kind of build them up, but is it, do you personally say, this is what I think it is, here's how bad it is? Or do you start at the other side and say, look, there's some things going on, you know, and do you work into it gradually, or what's your recommendation on dealing with parents?
No, I kind of hit it head on. But the funny thing is that people know, and I don't know how to explain it, you know, people know what's going on with their body. Like when they came in because they weren't feeling quite right, and then as you start to tell them and talk to them and you diagnose them with something that may sound awful, you know something, I haven't been feeling right for a long time. You know, all of this starts to make sense. You know, in emergency medicine, the thing I value most about emergency medicine is really allowed me to step back and take life in perspective. You know, the things that people kind of choose to stress out about and worry about, you know, you realize when you see both spectrums of life from birth to death, that you, it just puts things in perspective for you. You know, we work hard to provide for our families. You know, we work hard to get, you know, homes or buy cars and material possessions. But, you know, in my 12-year career, I've probably seen maybe between 100 and 200 people die. And on their deathbed, no one ever says, what's going to happen to my house? What's going to happen to my clothes? What's going to happen to all my material possessions? What people want is their family around them, and they want to know that, you know, that their life mattered, you know, for that period of time. And so I think that, you know, that's one of the things of what I'm thankful for, what medicine has given back to me. And because my experience in medicine is so extreme, it's life and death, it's just allowed me to have a more broad perspective of, you know, of our time here.
Wow.
It's kind of heavy for a high school program.
I was going to say, it got really solid in here. So I don't need a new car now. I thought I did.
Yeah, and then along those same lines, we're talking about, you guys ever been to Killen's Barbecue in Pearland? If you haven't, sure. It's phenomenal, and you'll understand why I'm saying that a second here. So my son, you know, I barbecue. I'm here in Texas, so I barbecue, and I do pretty good. Everybody that eats it likes it. But Killen's, you go to wait in line for an hour, and I'm planning to go back. I've already done it twice. I'm planning to go back again. It's amazing. So my four-year-old son was chowing down. He had a some brisket or something, and I had a beef rib and a pork rib. And he's like, oh, come on, Dad. You have two. Give me one. So I give him a piece of the beef rib. Well, it has some of the skin on there, and he starts to choke. and so at first, I'm like, oh, what do I do? But then because I teach conscious choking to my students all the time, we go over it like at least once a month, and I've been doing it for years. I'm like, okay, well, keep coughing. And then instead of picking him up and doing the back blows right there, I pick him up and start to take him right outside because it's about five steps away. Then he spits it up right beside the table that was sitting right there. But, you know, he starts coughing up. So like you were saying, the emergency action plan, not just sitting on the wall. If I had only trained in CPR once, it just going over it, you know, so I take him outside and he spits up just a little bit and then he's fine. goes back to town eating barbecue and killing. And I would too, if I, you know, but just you got to be prepared, and the only way to be prepared is to practice. Mm-hmm. You know, so the same here, we do the emergency situations once with the coaches a year. And, you know, I was talking with one of the athletic trainers, and he was saying, you know, I'm planning on getting one athlete from a sport, just randomly said, hey, here's what you need to do today. Just, you need to fall down on the court and pass out. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing. And then that way you see how they react. And the next time when it happens for real, they're not as surprised. And so, you know, just being prepared, being exposed to it, mm-hmm. going through the procedures, like you've been saying the whole time, that, you know, step by step by step, then like, oh, okay, now it's not a big deal.
And that's so, exactly what I mentioned earlier. And with this group is they're just so used to this air-conditioned room. It's quiet. There's no parents. There's no pressure. There's no mosquitoes. There's no humidity. And they're so used to that same scenario all the time, and that's all they practice in.
Sure.
I think that's brilliant. You have an athlete ran and let the coaching staff know. Maybe you even leave the gym and watch the panic ensue. And it's just, it's interesting. And then you come up to him and you say, I told you so. You know, it's completely different. I mean, even if they did it 50 times, I mean, I still get nervous when I run out on a football field just because I don't know what I'm expecting. But I mean, I hope to think that I can control the situation enough to take care of the athlete, but you just don't know what's going on. But it's different than when somebody says, okay, this kid's laying here with a spinal injury, take care of him. Well, you know everything already. And that's why head injuries bother me is, you know, is it really a true head injury? Did he just get hit and he's got a little soreness on his skin? Is it a brain injury? Is there trauma underneath? Is there neck? You know, there's so many things that may not show up. So I think that's the best way to do it is throw him into a situation where it seems it's a practical situation, even though it's, you know, obviously it's rehearsed or it's staged, but at least get them to see that, boom, this is real world here. You don't even have a crowd here. You don't have coaches. You don't have the mom screaming over your shoulder. And so that's from an athletic training side, that's the best way you can do it. And I know in the ER, like you said, you can't just go and randomly break a couple fingers and let them reset. That's your first real shot. I mean, other than, you know, practicing on the students, but you don't know what's coming in the door in 2 minutes. And that's awesome. I mean, I wish students could do those kind of rotations to see a true laceration, not, you know, a little cut and they got to take a steri strip and pull it across. But that's awesome for them.
I was just going to add to that. Another thing that's very important when you go through an emergency situation, things don't always go perfectly. And so after the whole experience is over, you need to pull your team together and do like a debriefing. Okay, what could we have done better here? You know, it took too long to get this medication here. When you do those things, you're then able to perfect your process such that when the next situation comes in, you say, okay, we're now better prepared to handle this so we're not so discombobulated, you know, because certain supplies are not in the right place. And a lot of, in the emergency room, a lot of it may be dictated on, you ended up putting the kid in the patient in the pediatric room because that was the only room available. And so nothing there is the right size for the patient that we're taking care of right there. So, you know, we now create carts such that if we need to move a cart to a room, no matter what room the patient's in, we have all the right equipment available for that patient, regardless of the room they've been placed in. And so those are little learning points you learn that you're never perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, you're never perfect, and so you always have to strive for perfection. And that means reviewing your work, reviewing your processes, such that you minimize any mistakes going forward.
All right. So, Dr. Lee, I know that the University of Houston Masters of Athletic Training Program is already hooked up with Memorial Hermann, and they're doing rotations.
Yep.
With you guys, and so they're going to be able to see some of those orthopedic injuries. But Dr. Aline, how do we get people like you involved in our school? And then two is, you know, our job as educators is to expose our kids to these things.
Sure.
So obviously, you know, I don't want to send high school kids following you around, but what's the best way for me to expose my kids to situations like that so that they are prepared if they're at a, you know, a game at HISD that doesn't have a student athletic trainer, or I mean a professional athletic trainer. So in your opinion, what can we do to?
Same thing that we do in medicine. You're never going to be exposed to every single situation, but you go through mock scenarios. and you say, okay, this is the situation. What are you going to do? And you change locales, okay? You may hold, you know, class in this forum because it's more video intensive. But then today we're going to go out on the athletic field and we're going to do simulation of someone being injured. And, you know, you'll position people where they would be positioned on game day or whatever, put someone way on the other side of the field, and you're going to run out as a team. How are you going to handle this? You have to go through that to really be prepared, because life itself is never going to prepare you for everything. There's certain things as an emergency physician I have not seen, you know, but I'm aware of how to take care of them. And a lot of it is regional. I trained in the Northeast, and so there weren't very many snake bites down there. We were trained for snake bites, read up all on snake bites. That benefited me when I came down here, because now I know and I see snake bites on a fairly regular basis. Another aspect of emergency medicine or subspecialty is cruise ship medicine, as well as wilderness medicine. And so those are things I have not been exposed to. But again, as long as the foundation has been laid, you then go through mock scenarios if you wanted to go into that environment, such that you would be prepared when you go out there. And again, the mock scenarios only prepare your reaction. It doesn't necessarily prepare you for what you're going to encounter, but you have enough foundation that you can adjust on the fly. It's kind of like there's this popular show on TV that I just got introduced to. It's called Naked and Afraid. All these people are survivalists, and they go out and they have to survive for 21 days. And some are hunters, some are fishers, but they never know what environment they're going to be put in. But they're survivalists at baseline. So when they get out there, they have to figure out, okay, I'm not near the water. There are no, you know, whatever for me to hunt. How am I going to make it through the situation? And that's very much how I see, being an emergency doctor. I've been prepared for multiple scenarios, but if a scenario that presents itself that I'm not familiar with, there's enough foundation there for me to adjust on the fly to make the right decision.
All right, so someone like Matt, he's a licensed athletic trainer. If sure. If he wanted to get some rotations in the emergency room,
sure.
I'm sure Memorial Hermann may have something set up, but what would be the kind of the process for him to just follow you around for a day?
I mean, for it to be really high yield for him, I don't think a freestanding emergency room is where he would need to be to get the most benefit. He would learn about emergency medicine. You know, this is how you take care of a kid that has the non-injury stuff, you know, fever, might have appendicitis, someone might chest pain, might be having a heart attack. Injuries by and far are not that common to say, okay, here is another injury. We got another injury. For him to get the most rich experience, I would recommend him be at, you know, a Ben Top type setting where people are coming in left and right, where, you know, he'll even have his own patients because there's so many people there. There's enough to go around. If you really want to get a true experience. I mean, I tell anyone that's interested in trauma or injuries, you need to have an urban experience. You mm-hmm. can't get that, you know, being out in Sugar Land or in Kingwood. You're never going to get that stuff. You have to, you got to be where all the action is happening. And Houston, the two hospitals or the three hospitals, it's either going to be Bentop, LBJ, or Memorial Southwest. Other than that, Methodist, no. St. Luke's, no. You're not going to get that true traumatic experience.
I think
Ben
Top, that's where gunshots yeah. and car. I mean, if you don't see it there, then yeah. you're never going to see it.
Right.
In the athletic field, anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So then the first part of the question I kind of skipped over is, how would I get you involved in what we're doing here? I mean, you know, we're partnered with Memorial Hermann, so sure. we have doctors on the sidelines. So what would your role be in our sports medicine team here?
I think what we would do is we can get together and let's actually sit down and create some of those mock scenarios that I was discussing. The other thing too is that I'm a firm believer in that skill sets transfer. So you may learn something in one environment, but because it creates that experience for you, you can now apply it in a different situation going forward. So for example, when I was a kid, my mother taught me some basic sewing, right? And so, but now that still helps me today as I learn to suture and sew when I'm fixing lacerations. So what I would want for the athletic program here is to have them develop clinical skills, practical skills that they can apply that, you know, they're learning it here as teenagers, but they'll remember, hey, I learned this in high school, and now this, I'm using it again in this environment. So, you know, as simple as bringing some pig's feet, let's make some lacerations and talk about different lacerations. Okay, this is what's considered a simple laceration that you can put Steri-Strips on, or the glue, Dermabond. This is something you're going to have to sew up, and show them the different layers of how you close something up. This is too wide. You can't just do a simple suture. You may have to do a mattress suture versus a deep layer closure. And so I think that's one of the things that when I was a student, one of the things that I valued. The other thing you can do, and I don't know how it works these days, let's have like a mini anatomy lab here. Let's bring in a cat or something, or and we open it up and dissect it, a pig, and say, okay, animals and human beings are pretty much set up the same way. So you cut them down the middle, your liver is going to be on your right-hand side, your lungs are going to be here in the middle. It just shows them, okay, this is what the body looks like, regardless of species. And so those are the things that stuck with me when I was younger, and, you know, I still carry those memories today.
Sweet. I like that. Definitely we'll look to set some stuff up to where you can kind of help teach our kids emergency situations.
Sure.
And, you know, prepare them for whatever. Because, you know, teaching CPR, I've had three of my students perform CPR on family or something like that. I have never done it. The closest I've got was what I told you when Jonah was eating brisket or pork or whatever it was. And so, you know, like you said, the skills transfer because we teach them here in the sterile environment, but they were able to do enough there. So, all right, well, I will get with you about that. Anybody else have any final comments about the time?
No, I don't know about you. I'm kind of nervous. I've had this tooth that's been bothering me for about 2 months. Dr. Lean has got me really nervous over here that I may be having some heart trouble because I've never heard of that before, and it's just – it's got me thinking.
So, it's just on the left side, though.
It's the left eye. Yeah. It's not painful. It's just, you know, every once in a while, I'm like, oh, I haven't felt that before. But
all right, here we go. Always helping people out. Okay, so then we'll go ahead and close it out. Definitely want to thank GHETS for allowing us to offer CEUs. Again, that has to be through the webinar, so you have to register and do the live event to get to earn the CEUs, but it's free CEUs while you're sitting at work. You just have to log into Google Hangout while you're in your office. You can interact or you can just listen. Or if you're downloading this and listening to it later, well then, you know, pretty much every Wednesday we're live. So you can jump in there and be part of what we're doing. Dr. Paul Aline volunteered himself to help out. I met him at not Fund for Teachers,
Pasadena Education Foundation.
Yeah, Education Foundation. So he's a supporter of the Education Foundation, which is, by the way, you can see the big checks there, has paid for a lot of the equipment that we have here. But he said, hey, you know, I'm a doctor in the area, emergency medicine, if there's anything I can do to help you. And so he, you know, thank you for volunteering and helping out. And so I think it's just, again, building resources and partnerships and doing what's going to be best for our kids to advance them and, you know, not just the athletes, but the student athletic trainers or the kids that are interested in sports medicine are doing what you do. So thank you again for volunteering.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you.
Our website is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. There's links to pretty much everywhere you can connect with me there. Twitter, PHS Sports Med, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, or Sports Medicine Broadcast on Google+, facebook.com/PHS Athletic Training, any other things. If they want to find out more about Neighbors Emergency Center,
NEC24.com.
NEC24.com. And then Memorial Hermann. That one's pretty easy.
What? There you go. .org.
And what about when Dr. Yellen's here, he always gives us a plug about the U of H.
HHP.UH.edu/MAT.
All right. So you can find out about any of those people there. And again, thank you guys for being here. So for Jeremy,
Paul Aline,
Andrew Lee,
Mark Knobloch,
Matt Barnes.
That's a wrap.